Let's go tonight to Genesis chapter 32. Genesis 32. Now really, you can't talk about Genesis 32 separate from chapter 33. So the whole theme is Jacob has left home because Esau has threatened to kill him. And 20 years have passed and he's now on the way back and he figures that when he arrives there that Esau is going to kill him. And so these two chapters, chapter 32 and 33, talk about how they got reconciled. And by way of introduction to these two chapters, which really are one story, we need to point out that there are four major parts to chapter 32 and 33. The first one, and probably the most significant one, is also the shortest, and that is the vision of the camp of God. The vision of the camp of God only takes up two verses, but it is one of the four major parts of these chapters, and it takes in verses 1 and 2, which read, "As Jacob was on his way, the angels of God met him." And that's it. There's a comment on it in verse 2. Jacob said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named that place Mahanaim. Vision of the camp of God is significant to these chapters. Second, Jacob figures, I'm going to have to somehow assuage the hatred and the wrath of my brother. So beginning in chapter 32 and verse 3, he begins a preparation of a gift that he feels will settle the vengeance. So the preparation of a gift, and that is chapter 3 down through verse 21. If you go down to verse 20, you have the purpose of the gift. He's going to give him over 500 cattle. And in verse 20, "You shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him, Esau, with the present that goes before me." So he's going to buy off the vengeance of his brother that he anticipates seeing. Following that, he has a fight with God at Peniel. His fight with God, he wrestles with God at the brook Jabbok. And that's all part of this whole thing. Chapter 32, and that is verses 22 through 32. And then finally, the whole 33rd chapter has to do with reconciliation with Esau. All of chapter 33, comprising 20 verses. So you can see, this is all one event. The vision of God is part of it. He gets the gift ready to give to buy off the vengeance of his brother. He wrestles with God at Jabbok. And finally, in chapter 33, the entire chapter is about how he meets Esau and how they reconcile their differences and how they have peace. Those are the four major parts. Second, there are several major doctrinal ideas. Number one, the vision, taking up those two tiny verses, the vision to the whole thing is central. And the way in which it is central is this. It shows that those that are for Jacob are more than those that are against Jacob. Those that are for Jacob, being angels, are more and superior to any opposition that he could face. So that in this context, you have an opening up and the invisible forces of God are exposed. Second, coming down to verse 9, Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me," and you have the prayer, that is there is an example, a good example for us. It's an example of what prayer should be like. And we will find it will have four aspects to it. Third, when Jacob goes back, what he's really trying to do is restore the blessing that he had stolen. Jacob is trying, and we'll be told directly, he's trying to restore the stolen blessing. He stole the birthright, and now he wants to restore the blessing back to Esau that he had taken away from him 20 years earlier. That's seen in several ways. It's seen by the fact that all the cattle that he had were given him by God through blessing, and he says, Esau, I want you to take them. I'm giving them back to you. Second, the repeated remark that goes through the whole context that he is the servant of Esau. Let's trace that out because it's a very important theme. Chapter 32, verse 4. Now remember in the covenant made with him, he was made to be leader over his brother or leader over Esau. And now he's trying to give that back. And notice almost with a groveling attitude he speaks in verse 4. He commanded them saying, this is what you're to do when you see Jacob, Esau. He also commanded them saying, thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob. Verse 5. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord, speaking of Esau. Verse 18, then you shall say, these belong to your servant, Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord, Esau. Verse 20, and you shall say, behold, your servant, Jacob. 33 continues the same thing in verse 5. He lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children. This is Esau, and said, whose are these with you to Jacob? So he, Jacob, said, the children whom God has graciously given, your servant. Verse 8, and he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. Verse 13, but he said, my Lord knows that the children are frail. And this is Jacob speaking to Esau. Verse 14, please, my Lord. Last part of verse 14, I come to my Lord at Sur. Verse 15, what need, last sentence, what need is there, let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So that it's obvious, the blessing that had fallen on him, which was to rule over Esau, he's trying to give back. The cattle that God had blessed him with, he's trying to give back. So there's a definite tone that Jacob thinks the only reconciliation that can be achieved is when we restore these things, and we'll find out that is truly wrong. All right, let's break it down then into its parts. Number one, the vision of the camp of God. Chapter 32, 1 and 2. First of all, these words are very brief, but they're also very significant. In fact, this whole event that you have in this verse is reported in four Hebrew words, and four only. Our English text is more wordy. As Jacob went on his way, and here are the words, the angels of God met him. And so while there are six words used in English, in between those words, the angels of God met him, you have only four words. Brief, but significant. And basically what happens is this. God's invisible world entered Jacob's visible world. God's invisible world entered Jacob's visible world. And that's what occurs and what's reported in four words in the Hebrew Bible in verse 1. Now, that accounts for the name that he gives the place. He calls the name of the place Mahanaim. In English, we have singular and plural. Hebrew adds one other. Hebrew has singular, dual, and plural. And the word Mahanaim is a dual form in the Hebrew, and therefore that accounts for the names, so that the invisible world of God enters the visible world of Jacob, and thus the name. Two camps. Mahanaim, two camps. And probably what he had in mind would be his whole household and the angels that he saw in verse 1 as another household. So that this accounts for the name of it. The next thing to note is this. In this event of verse 1, again repeated in only four words in Hebrew, this word, this event is very similar to appearance of God at Bethel. In fact, there are some irresistible similarities. God appeared to him at Bethel, and this is very similar to that event. Now, there is no way that you would see those similarities from the English text, and if in the next few minutes we're giving some technical points, it's because you can only see this similarity if you're reading the Hebrew text. First of all, and the first one you can see, in chapter 32, verse 1, it speaks of the angels of God. And if you'll hold your finger in chapter 28, because we'll want to compare for a minute. First point of similarity is the angels of God. The angels of God is found in 32:1 and 28:12. So that if you go back to 28:12, the appearance of God at Bethel, it says, he, Jacob, had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending, ascending and descending on it. And the interesting thing about that is the reference to angels of God in 32:1 and angels of God in 28:12 are found nowhere else in the whole Old Testament. They're found only there and nowhere else in the Old Testament is that exact expression used. So when you think of one event or two events like this with the same man and with a similarity like that, that's got to be significant. Second, the words met him, the words met him, that are found in 32:1, angels of God met him, are found also in 28:11. And if you go back to 28:11, you will look for a long time, but you will never find them unless they're shown to you. So verse 11, he came to a certain place, spent the night there, because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. And the word that is used in 28:11 is he came. In both places, it's came over there, met him in 32:1, but it's the same Hebrew verb, paga. So that's another linguistic link between the two. Third, the pronoun this is another similarity. If you go back to 28, it occurs four times. 28 and verse 16. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place. And that gets an emphasis in Hebrew. And I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And that same word is used over in chapter 32, verse 1, verse 2. Jacob said to them when he saw them, this is God's camp. So the pronoun this in 28, 16, and 17 occurring four times, and in 32, verse 2. Fourth link between the two. In both cases, Jacob interpreted before he named. In both cases, Jacob interpreted before he named. He gave the significance and the meaning before he attached a name to it. If you go back to chapter 28, verse 16. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, now notice this is the interpretation, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. And he interpreted it, but notice, in verse 19, he names it. In verse 19, he called the name of the place Bethel. The same thing in chapter 32. Verse 2, Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named the place Mahanaim. He interpreted before he named in both cases. Fifth similarity between the two texts. And that is this. The expression, going in the way, occurs both places. It's found in 32:1, but it is also found in 28:20, which reads, by saying, then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take. So that I take, and again you would not see it in English because it's not there. The words journey or that I take is a translation of the same word that's used in 32. 28 and verse 20. So that this, going in the way, 32:1, is the same as this that I take over here. And in both cases, just for your information, in both cases it's the word halak plus the Hebrew word for way, which is derek. And this uses halak derek, and 28:20 uses halak derek. There is a similarity between the two events. Sixth. The event of Genesis 28 corresponds to chapter 32. So the event at Bethel corresponds to the other. So that, going now over to chapter 32, as Jacob approaches the promised land, he approaches the camp of God. And what that means is that as you come into this land, this is the land where God dwells. And therefore his fellowship with the Lord, his knowledge of God is tied in with his presence in the land of Palestine. So really, he's leaving the danger of Laban. He thinks he's going to face the danger of Esau. And now God meets him at the edge of the promised land and he says, let me pull back the curtain. And I want you to see, this is where God lives. This is where he dwells. And there's something unique about this land that is not true of any other land in the world. The vision of God, verses 1 and 2. Now you'd think that a man who had seen the invisible would take tremendous courage. I mean, if God splits heaven open and we see all the angels that are on my side, you would think when he sees Esau coming with 400 men, he wouldn't be afraid. But there is a principle, which we'll talk about later. No matter what we see and grasp and understand of the invisible, what is always more real than the invisible? The visible. So you can see the angels of heaven, but that's not half as scary and not half as awesome as seeing Esau coming down the road with 400 men. And that principle works over and over again. All right, with that now, he's got to prepare a gift for his brother who he thinks is coming to annihilate him. Preparation of the gift. And that is found in 3 through 21. And we focus first of all on the messengers. And and the one sent, and the ones coming back. First of all, the one sent. Verse 3. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, "Thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban, stayed until now. I've got oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." So he sends them off, noting the fact that he has something to give. He's not coming to beg, but he has something to offer and something to give. The wrath of Esau, or what he thinks is the wrath of Esau, is going to be handled three ways. Four ways, rather. It's going to be handled three ways. Jacob is a man of backups. He trusts God, but he always has a plan in case God goofs up. That's inevitable with Jacob. Is, yes, there's trust, but you can't tell when God might lose his footing, so we better have plan B. Sort of in this contest, God was plan A, and his plans, if in case they didn't work out, we could go to plan B, C, and D. Okay, first, he's going to attempt negotiation. And that's in verses 3 through 5. Let's see if we can win his favor. Be nice to him. Use the right words. Don't say, "Thus shall you say to Esau, thus says Jacob." Say, "Thus shall you say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob." So you're going to negotiate in a way that is pleasing. And you also need to know that I haven't gone broke and I'm just coming to my brother to beg. Because I've got oxen, I've got donkeys, I've got flocks, male and female, and I would like to find favor in your sight. I'm your servant. I've got plenty of wealth. I want to find your favor. Emphasis, maybe I can negotiate my way around his wrath or his supposed wrath. Second, he tries organization. Tactical organization. And that is in verses 7 and 8. He hears that the servants come back and say, Esau's on the way, he's got 400 men with him. Scares the wits out of Jacob in verse 7, and he immediately institutes a plan. Then Jacob was afraid and distressed. He divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. He said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. Now, this is not Jacob simply being fair, saying, look, some of us are going to die. I want to be fair. So, over here, heads or tails? If you guess tails, you go on the right. If you guess heads, you're going to go on the left. It wasn't that kind of arrangement. He set the ones that he had the least affection for first, and the one that he had the most affection for last. And guess who that was? Believe it or not, it was Jacob. Go over to chapter 33. He sets up a defense of four women and a bunch of children. Chapter 33 shows what his preference was. Chapter 33, verse 1, Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming. And he had set it all up, so you're going to have to plow down the women and the children before you get to me. He was coming with 400 men with him, so he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. Leah and Rachel, and of course, Bilhah and Zilpah would be the two maids. And he put the maids and their children in the front. They get wiped out first. And Leah and her children next. Rachel and Joseph last, and then he himself passed on ahead of them, bound to the ground seven times. Apparently it comes from the rear, goes up there, and but you notice there is a preferential arrangement there that is going to come off. So chapter 32, back to verse 7. That's his plan. Now you might as well throw in a little prayer. Couldn't hurt. And so you come down to verse 9, and he decides he will try a little intercession. And the intercession is found in verses 9 through 12. It's a good prayer. It's a prayer that a lot, from which we can learn a lot. Then in verse 13, he spent the night there. He selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, and this amounts to over 500 animals. So if all of the other things do not work, then we are going to try as a fourth method, conciliation. And that's in verses 13 through 21. Jacob must have really known how to do things up big. The way he doesn't just march 500 cattle at him. He puts them in increments so that as he comes seeing his present, it's sort of like, so you'll be impressed that you're getting a lot of things for Christmas. We'll break them up into lots of little tiny packages so you'll get a better impression that you got many things. And Jacob is good at that, and he divides the cattle up into impressive groups so that here come some donkeys. Next come the camels. Next come the lambs. Next comes this and that. So that it's a series of impressions he's going to make, and he's going to sweep him off his feet. So notice he's got everything all lined up. We'll negotiate. We'll organize for the worst if it happens. Throw in a little prayer into the thing. Let's mix that in also. Maybe we can enlist God's help, and maybe we can conciliate, and we'll give him these waves of gifts that will be marching up to him, and surely this will win the day. Okay, following the messengers, notice in verse 6, they return. And the messengers return to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau. Furthermore, he's coming to meet you with 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and then he puts his little plan into operation to separate them. Basically, the tension that this verse talks about that he experienced was from two sources. Two things left Jacob very uptight. And the twofold source was his own doing in the past. I mean, he had cheated his brother. And he was plagued by that. And he figured that because of what I did in the past, that I am going to suffer now. But that wasn't the only source of tension. The second source of tension was his own imagination in the present. He just knows what Esau's going to do to him. In other words, he was just absolutely certain that Esau was coming to fight. He was coming to bless, but coming to fight was all that he could think of. There's an interesting principle there. A guilty conscience can find any event a threat. I can illustrate that so easily. I literally freeze when a police car is behind me on the freeway. And there's only one reason. It's guilt. I know that 99% of the time I'm not doing 55 miles an hour. Not my fault, but it's just the way the car's built. And consequently, I say, you know, even though I look down, I'm going 55. I'm doing okay. I got my, well, I don't have my seatbelt on, but have you ever tried to sneak one on, you know, without anybody in the other car seeing you? That's hard to do. I got in a ticket about a year and a half ago down here on this curve. He stopped me, and I knew he was running my license through and all that sort of thing, and I thought I could somehow get up and get that thing. And, you know, of all times that thing would lock. You couldn't pull it down any way you tried. And divine judgment, I suppose. I don't know. But nonetheless, guilt sees in almost everything a threat. And that's the way Esau is. Jacob is. He's guilty. He stole from his brother. He lied to his brother. He pulled a lousy trick on his brother. And here comes his brother with 400 men. What else can you think? He's going to kill me. Well, that's the guilty conscience in operation. And you're all smiling because that means you understand exactly what I'm saying because you've been in the same place. Okay, the tension then comes from two sources. Imagination, because of a guilty conscience that sees, cannot see his brother coming in a friendly way, only sees him coming to wiping out. So, verse 7. It's interesting how easily he's willing to give up what God gave him in order to save lives. And that leads us into the prayer. Let's intercede now. And the prayer basically has four parts to it. And they're all really instructive, verses 9 through 12. Each verse has an aspect of prayer to it. Number one, he pleads God's purpose. Verse 9, he pleads God's purpose. Verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me, return to your country and to your relatives. In other words, God, you said it. You said your purpose and plan for me was to come back to this land. And therefore, in his prayer, he wants to plead this purpose. Or can we paraphrase it for maybe a little easier understanding? Lord, you know it. If it hadn't been for your word, I would have been hundreds of miles away from this spot. I wouldn't be here where my brother is pursuing me to wipe me out if it hadn't been for you. So you got me in this mess. You get me out of it. If there's one thing that's true in the Old Testament, and it's the Jew knew how to Jew God. And often the petition was this. If I get wiped out, God, you're going to look bad. And would argue on that basis that you need to save me in your own interest. And basically that's what he's saying, is at this particular point, Lord, I didn't come up here of my own choice. I didn't wander here. You told me to go here. Now, the wolves are at the door. You take care of them. And that's the first part of his prayer that is there. Now notice in verse 9, when Jacob says, in addressing God, he calls him the God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, does not mean that he's not his God. It does mean this, that you were faithful to Abraham, be faithful to me. You were God and you were faithful to Isaac, you be faithful to me too. In other words, he pleads the fact of God's purpose in verse 9. In verse 10, he pleads God's grace. Verse 10, he pleads God's grace. Two simple themes. His unworthiness is set beside God's faithfulness. And that's the verse 10. His unworthiness is set beside God's faithfulness. Verse 10, I am unworthy of all the loving kindness. If that isn't a perfect definition, what do you usually call grace? Grace is unmerited favor. Isn't that what he's saying? I'm unworthy of all the loving kindness, all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant, for with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two companies. I'm enough to divide up into two small armies, and that's all due to your blessing. And so in his prayer is, while you have purpose for me, you are going to need to act and continue to act toward me in grace. Third, he pleads God's protection. His purpose, his grace, his protection. Verse 11. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, the mothers with the children. there's very colorful expressions here in the Hebrew where it's got the mothers upon the children. And the allusion would be in the attack that the mothers would try to protect the little children with their own bodies, and thus the expression mothers upon their children. And he sees this as a massive slaughter of Rachel and Leah and all the kids, and doubtless himself too. So 11, deliver me, I pray you. Now there's an interesting link there, is that the word translated deliver in this verse, deliver in 32:11, is translated in verse 20. Verse 30 of the same chapter. He's wrestled with God at Peniel, calls the name of the place Peniel at the brook Jabbok. So verse 30, Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. The word deliver in 32:11 is the same verb as the word translated preserved in 32:30. So that the prayer is in verse 11, preserve me, and in verse 30, God does that. He preserves him. But there is an interesting link. When he asked to be delivered, he asked to be delivered from Esau. When he's preserved in chapter 32 and verse 30, he had met God. So let's put down a principle then. When Jacob was blessed by God, he was delivered from Esau. When Jacob was blessed by God, it was then he was delivered from Esau. When Jacob was blessed by God, he was delivered from Esau. Doesn't that come back to another you see the principle that we've been over so many, many times? When his relationship with God is right, everything else is right. When he meets God and is in right relationship to him, Esau is no problem. So he was delivered from Esau by meeting God. And that is a tremendously important principle that is there. Finally, and fourth, in the prayer, he pleads God's promise. Verse 12. Notice, by the way, the prayer ends and begins the same way. It begins by, you said, and it ends with, you said. Verse 12 of chapter 32. For thou didst say, I shall surely prosper you, make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. And that's exactly the way the prayer began. The prayer began by saying, Lord, you said. And when he says amen, he says, Lord, you said. So he has a firm basis, great lessons as far as prayer is concerned. We, as believers, can plead God's purpose. He's called us for a reason. We're in the age of his grace. We can plead his protection. Lo, I am with you even to the end of the age, he said in Matthew. And we can certainly plead all the promises that are applicable to us. Well, the next section is made up of some unnecessary efforts. Verse 13. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys. This is quite an array. And then he delivers them to his servants. He is attempting to give back the blessing that he had stolen. Look over at 33:11. Get that interpretation. Esau doesn't want to take these things because he says, I have plenty. But really what Jacob is trying to do is ease his conscience. He says, please take my gift, which has been, this is 33:11. Please take my gift which is brought to you by God, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty. So in 33:11, notice he says, please take my gift. Notice gift has a one by it, and if you take it out on the margin, what have you got? Please take my blessing. In other words, the blessing given me by God, I want to give back to you. So there's a certain element of trying to relieve his conscience by returning these things to his brother. Well, he gives the servants instruction as to what they're to do. And then finally, in verse 20, he gives the intention of the gift, which is, I hope this will appease him. All right, in closing, let's make a few observations. And since he gave 550 animals back to as a present, I figured it was appropriate that we make 550 observations before we go home. So, number one of 550. Number one, God provides resources in an adequate and timely manner, whether we use them or not. God provides resources in an adequate and timely manner, whether or not we use them. And what I'm deriving that off of is, at the opening of this event, God pulled back the heavens and said, look at the angels. There they are. There are the unseen forces. The unseen forces were probably in his mind until verse 6. And in verse 6, heck with the invisible forces. And he says, the messenger returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. And with that, angels, invisible forces, invisible nothing. These 400 guys have got swords. And so God had given him the resource in verse 1, but he apparently does not use it as soon as he sees Esau and the 400 coming with him. When we talk about invisible resources, let's add one other thing. When he sees the angels of heaven, there are two ways, and says there are two camps. That could be taken two ways. Does he mean there are two camps, I'm one and the angels are one, or does he mean there are two camps of angels? You really can't say for sure. Really, the meaning comes out the same way. You can get a little bit more dramatic if it's two camps of angels, because that would illustrate the principle that's often used in the Old Testament, that God takes care of me from before and behind. And so the idea could be two camps of angels, and here's Jacob. And angels go before him, and angels follow him, could be the idea. Or it could be one camp of angels and his camp. Essentially, you come out with the same thing, whichever way you go. Number two, the visible usually, you hate to say this, but it's true, the visible usually obscures the invisible. The visible usually obscures the invisible. Third, and here's a point just of interpretation that we need to be careful with. The significance of an event should not be judged. Significance of an event should not be judged merely by the words used to describe it. Here's what I mean. The whole appearance of the angels was described in four words. But there are no four words more significant than those. It is characteristic of God to always do this. He puts the most profound truth in the simplest terms. If I can remember Christmas, we did that on Luke 2, 1 through 7. And we went with how many were the account of the birth of Jesus. And we found, I think, two four-syllable words in that account. 100 and just double digits, 13 or something, triple syllable, and 30 something, dual syllable, and like 112 or 113 single syllable. It is the characteristic of God to take the greatest events and put it in the simplest terms. As we said, that contrasts man, because the more man digs into a particular field, the more impossible it is to understand him. Fourth, caution should always be exercised in passing judgment on actions. Caution should be used in judging actions. And I'll illustrate what I mean by that. Now, let me give you this as a means of self-defense against preachers. Because preachers, I've said before, know the things that preach. I mean, you know that this point, if I can make it, is going to turn people on. And preachers will do that. Just because they're a particularly kind of Jacob-like, deceiving bunch. And you've got to be careful that you don't become the victim of that. And let me give an example. Doesn't it preach well to say, look at Jacob going to all of this preparing of the animals and the gift? How could he do that? Why didn't he just trust God? And that preaches, doesn't it? Because here's his prayer, and you could take that prayer and say everything around it is surrounded by a lack of faith. Says who? Well, I know says the preacher, but that's nobody. Says who? Let me ask a couple of questions. Did his gift to Esau contradict faith, or was it just smart? You want to prove that to me from the text, please? I know you can read the event and come up with your own conclusion and say it must have, but that's not good enough. Let me ask you this. Could God not have used this gift to as an instrument to appease Esau? Could he do a thing like that? Certainly could. So if the text does not pass judgment, we should be careful. Does the gift negate faith? Perhaps. But we can't prove it. We can say it's unnecessary, as it turned out, because it was unnecessary, apparently. But unnecessary does not mean sinful. Be careful of adding our own interpretation to event. Now, if God rebuked him for the gift and said that contradicts faith, that's different. But it doesn't say that. So be careful of coming to that conclusion, because I think probably I could have led you down that path tonight, and we could have structured things in such a way that his preparation to divide into two camps, and his using of the gifts could all been made to say total contradiction of faith. That is not necessarily the case. It may be, but I can't say that because the text does not say that. You come to some interesting conclusions when you make up your mind just to stay with the text. Okay. Last principle. And this is just a principle you might want to remember of a psychological principle. Fierce anger and bitterness is sometimes cured by giving it time. Fierce anger is sometimes cured by time. And I know of no better example of that than here. When he left home, Esau was going to kill him. 20 years passes. Esau comes forth to meet him in blessing and welcome him back home with joy. And there is your principle, that sometimes fierce anger is cured by time. We tend to always want to deal with things right up front, don't we? We think that's a great virtue. Sometimes things need to just let them sit and give them the time for God to bring them around in His own way. Father, once again, thank You for Your Word in Christ's name. Amen.